The following study is a Wednesday night lesson given by Pastor Brett Metter at Athey Creek Christian Fellowship.
All right. First, I'd like you to turn to 2 Samuel chapter 12, and we're going to review something real quick, and then we'll jump ahead to where we are, 2 Samuel chapter 18. First, 2 Samuel chapter 12, there's one of the things we need to remember that happened here about David and about the story that's before us, and it's something for us to remember, and that is you always get nailed by sin. Sin always comes back and gets you. Oh, the Lord will forgive you, and he is merciful, and praise the Lord, his mercy endures forever, and his grace is, in fact, sufficient. But the truth is, David, while he was forgiven and received the mercy of God, and we'll see David in heaven because of that, the rest of his life would be deeply troubling. And we're reminded of that here in 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 10. And there Nathan the prophet reminds David in verse 10. It says, "Now therefore the sword shall never depart from thy house, because thou hast despised me, and hath taken the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be thy wife. Thus saith the Lord, behold, I will raise up evil against thee out of thine own house, and I will take thy wives before thine eyes, and give them to thy neighbor, and he shall lie with thy wives in the sight of the sun. For thou did it secretly, but I will do this thing before all Israel and before the sun." This is a reminder of what happened. Even though the Lord will, in fact, forgive David, we'll see him always have the edge of the sword to deal with, and battles and troubles. And we're kind of in the thick of it, really, with the story of Absalom. And so back to 2 Samuel chapter 18, we see that bloody, kind of brutal story continue. And we left off in chapter 18. In chapter 18, last week, we saw, of course, Absalom killed as he was hung by his hair from the tree, the oak tree, and then Joab, stuck him through with some darts, arrows, or whatever. And then Absalom's armor bearers, which he had several, because he probably had all kinds of weapons of warfare, and these guys would carry, I can almost see Joab walking around clanking. It's like he's got this clankety thing because he's got weapons and he's just this tough, bloody man. And probably scars on his face. That's the kind of guy Joab was. Plus, he had a whole posse of guys that carried all his weapons for him. I mean, this guy's the real deal. And so Joab goes and kills Absalom, and all his men with the other weapons come and kill him as well. And they throw him into a pit and cast stones on him and bury him. Now, if you recall, it's the burial of the one who would be cursed hanging upon a tree, if you recall that from Deuteronomy 21, verses 22 and 23. And that happened there in chapter 18. And then we sort of pick up where we left off in verse 18. It's 2 Samuel 18, 18. It says, "Now Absalom, in his lifetime, had taken and reared up for himself a pillar, which is in the Kingsdale. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. And he called the pillar after his own name, and it is called unto this day Absalom's place." Interesting that this guy builds sort of a pillar and monument to himself. That's kind of a worldly king sort of thing. That's a Nebuchadnezzar or a Pharaoh kind of thing. You don't see the children of Israel building monuments to themselves or definitely not the Lord directing them in that. Now, by the way, there's some of you that have been to Israel, and if you've been there in Jerusalem in the Kidron Valley, you'll be told by your tour guide or whoever took you through there that there's Absalom's pillar or Absalom's place. And they say that that's what it is. And there's this sort of a building that's an ancient building. It is, in fact, an ancient building. And maybe you remember it's got kind of a hole in it, and it's got a round, pointy top with a ball on top. If you've seen that, you might think, oh, this is what that is. But oftentimes they'll call it Absalom's tomb there in Jerusalem. Absalom's place, Absalom's pillar, Absalom's tomb. But the one that you see there in Israel is not, in fact, Absalom's tomb. It was built right around the time of Christ, at least somewhere in the first century. And Josephus even writes about that particular thing. It's kind of an interesting deal because it was associated with Absalom, but it wouldn't have been Absalom's pillar, just for your FYI. By the way, for centuries there in Jerusalem, that building that you do see, Muslims, Jews, and Christians would walk by that and throw rocks at it. And there was a reason, and it had to do with the rebellious son. The Muslims, the Jews, the one thing they could all agree is throw rocks at Absalom's tomb. The parents of those Jewish children, Christian children, Muslim children would say, let that be a reminder, Junior, that when you rebel against your parents, there'd be a big tomb there for you when you die. And they would throw rocks reminding their children, don't be acting like Absalom. So that's just kind of an FYI sort of a, but that's not the pillar mentioned here. We don't really know where that pillar is, and we haven't found that pillar necessarily. So it's kind of interesting. But that's always a bad thing when you're building a monument to yourself. Now, some of you would say, well, I've never built a pillar or a big statue of myself. But it is interesting when we start to, you know, build our career as sort of a pillar that's a monument unto ourselves, or a business that we have, or, you know, our home might even wrongly be in that place where we're trying to have people see, wow, look at them. Look what they have achieved and what they've, you know, built or whatever. And or even the car we drive. It's funny how we can kind of associate things we have, material possessions, and even become prideful about our link to that thing that makes people think something of us or not. That's always a bad sign when you're hoping for status by something that you have, something to kind of tuck away. That's an Absalom-esque kind of behavior there. Well, then it goes on. So Absalom's dead and buried, but David doesn't know what happened yet. So in those days, they would send runners or messengers to go and, you know, get the news to David. And so the guy that would normally do that, well, we meet him here in verse 19. Then said Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, let me now run and bear the king tidings now, how that the Lord hath avenged him of his enemies. And Joab said unto him, thou shalt not bear tidings this day, but thou shalt bear tidings another day. But this day thou shalt bear no tidings, because the king's son is dead. And then, verse 21, then said Joab to Cushi. Now, if you have a newer translation, you might think, well, what is it? Is he a Cushite, or is his name Cushi? Well, he's a Cushite. The King James almost treats it like it's a name. Okay, Cushi. He's got a real cushy job, I guess, that he's given here to be the runner. But the idea is he's a Cushite. We don't know his name, actually, so he's called Cushi or the Cushite. For those of you that are wondering. Now, a Cushite was a guy who was from Ethiopia, or that whole region sort of southwest of Egypt. And some people believe the Cushites were like Nubians or what have you. And so it's interesting that his job was to be a runner, because some of the fastest runners in the world come from that area of the world. It's kind of interesting. So Cushi, this guy from Africa, is there. And instead of Ahimaaz, it says in verse 20, then says Joab to Cushi, go and tell the king what thou hast seen. And Cushi bowed himself unto Joab and ran. So the question then is presented, why did Joab tell Ahimaaz, sorry, you're not going to bear the king's news today? And then he turns to the Cushite and says, you're going to bear the news to the king today. Why did Ahimaaz get sort of rejected by Joab to tell the king's news? Now, the truth is, we don't know for sure. Some make the argument that Ahimaaz didn't know enough information, and the Cushite did somehow have all the information. We'll see evidence of that argument here in a second. Others believe, no, everybody liked Ahimaaz. He was a good guy. The Bible's going to tell us that later, that he was a good man. And maybe it was Joab who's saying, man, I don't want this guy Ahimaaz to go and tell the news, because, well, so far, how does David often respond to the messengers who bring bad news? If you recall, there's a couple examples in 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 15, when David hears the news of Saul and Jonathan's death, and he kills the Amalekite, the messenger who brings that information. And there's another example in chapter 4, verse 12, where David gets news and he kills the guy. So maybe Joab's like, Ahimaaz, you're not the delivery of this message of Absalom's death. So maybe it's just that. But what's interesting about the whole thing is Ahimaaz really, 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 really wants to bring the message to David. He wants to be the one who brings the news. And the question is, why? Now, I don't know. You know, this brings all kinds of questions for me. Maybe Ahimaaz is a likable guy, but he's also the guy that loves to tell the news. You know, and good news or bad news, he likes to bring the news. Maybe that's it. Others say he's a good guy, but he's also trying to protect himself. And you'll see why that is perhaps the case here in a minute as well. So you got these two guys that are runners, Ahimaaz and the Cushite. And the Cushite takes off, and Ahimaaz, well, verse 22, then said Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, yet again to Joab, but howsoever, let me, I pray thee, also run after the Cushite. And Joab said, wherefore wilt thou run, my son, seeing that thou hast no tidings ready? See, apparently Abishai doesn't have the full story. That's kind of the idea. Somehow the Cushite saw it all with his own eyes, or he was already briefed. But this other guy, Ahimaaz, doesn't seem to have the whole story. That's one of the reasons, that's an argument of why he didn't go. But verse 23, howsoever, said he, let me run. And he said unto him, run. Go ahead. Knock yourself out. I think it's crazy, just the general running anyway. You runners out there. he says, go run. So then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and overran Cushi. Yeah, how does a Jewish guy overrun an Ethiopian? Come on. Well, it sort of implies that he knew some kind of a shortcut, because it says he ran the way of the plain, whereas Cushi didn't. So it's kind of an interesting for you runners. You know, 2 Samuel chapter 18, it's all about running. Maybe he had better running shoes. I don't know. But he overruns this guy Cushi. And verse 24, and David sat between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof over the gate unto the wall, and lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, a man running alone. Now, by the way, I told you, you walk down the Valley Kidron and you see this place they call Absalom's tomb, and it's not really it. What's really amazing about the Kidron Valley and the city of David and the ancient Jerusalem of David's time, you can see this very wall and the very gate where David sat in this part of the story today in Jerusalem. It's really one of the more incredible digs in the last 10 years. When I first started taking tours, tour groups over to Israel, the city of David was largely undiscovered, I should say, and hadn't been dug up archaeologically. But as we speak, they're doing all these amazing digs in the city of David in Jerusalem, and it's incredible. If you ever want to go online, look up the City of David archaeological digs, and you'll see all kinds of cool stuff, because the walls, the gates, some of these gates, part of them are underground. You have to go under this tunnel into this underground area where they've dug out the ancient walls of the City of David and the towers that were there at the gates. They're all underground. Well, why don't they just dig it up? Why do they go under a tunnel? Because there's houses on top. People live there, which is a whole other controversial thing. The Palestinians used to live up there, but the Jews started buying all the homes of the, just, you know, the Palestinians would put their home up for sale, and then the Jews would buy their house. And then after the reason they were doing that is the Jews are trying to preserve their own history in Jerusalem, while the Palestinians want to destroy the history of the Jews in Jerusalem. The Palestinians today claim the Jews never really even had a Temple Mount on what is called the Dome of the Rock mosque or shrine today. So it's very controversial, the City of David, and there's all kinds of skirmishes and riots and rock throwing that takes place in that region. We have to be kind of careful when we take our tour group there because of the tension that's there about the City of David and the unearthing of what is proving that David was there, the Jews were there, 3,000 years ago. Kind of interesting. So all that to say, when we go to Israel next November, that's one of the things we're going to go see is this wall where David's just sitting there watching and waiting. And all of a sudden, they see this lone runner coming, you know, up the valley or down the hill of the, you know, Mount of Olives. Well, it says, verse 25, and the watchman cried and told the king, and the king said, if he be alone, there is tidings in his mouth. In other words, he's bringing news. And he came apace and drew near. And the watchman saw another man running. And the watchman called unto the porter and said, behold, another man running alone. And the king said, he also brings tidings. And the watchman said, methinketh the running of the foremost is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. Apparently he had a running style that was, kind of clear. Oh, that's Ahimaaz. Maybe he ran like Bolt or something. You know, Bolt runs like no other. You know, I don't know. But he was recognized by his running. And then, and so he says, hey, the one that's in the front looks like Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. And the king said, he is a good man and comes with good tidings. Isn't that interesting? That David assumes that Ahimaaz has good news because he's just a good guy. Joab wouldn't have sent Ahimaaz if it was bad news. I mean, that's David's thinking. Maybe, by the way, that's one of the reasons why Joab didn't want to send Ahimaaz. Maybe Joab was perceptive enough to know that the victory over Absalom and Absalom's death was not going to be good news to David. Maybe that's why he didn't want the good guy bringing the message, and he also didn't want David to chop him up. This is all speculation. We don't know exactly why this comes down the way it does. So he says, it must be good news. So verse 28, and Ahimaaz called and said unto the king, all is well. And he fell down onto the earth upon his face before the king and said, blessed be the Lord thy God, which hath delivered up the men that lifted up their hand against my lord the king. And the king said, is the young man Absalom safe? Now, if you recall, David earlier commanded his men, do not lay a hand on Absalom. You know, you have to defeat his army, kill them, but you got to keep Absalom alive, bring him alive. That's a tall order. But they didn't accomplish that. So that's the first thing David asked, is my son Absalom alive? Is he safe? And Ahimaaz answered, when Joab sent the king's servant and me, thy servant, I saw a great tumult, but I knew not what it was. In other words, I don't have the foggiest idea about Absalom. Now, is that true or false? We don't really know. I think, if I had to guess, I think he did know that Absalom was dead. He just wasn't willing to tell that part of the news to David. And I'll tell you the reason why. If you go back to verse 19, it says, then said Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, let me now run and bear the king's tidings, how that the Lord hath avenged him of his enemies. And Joab said unto him, thou shalt not bear the tidings this day, but thou shalt bear tidings another day. But this day thou shalt bear no tidings, because the king's son is dead. Now he either just kind of forgot to hear that part, or he's telling a little bit of a fib here. Man, it was just so much of a tumult, the battle, the dust was still settling. Can't really say. Can't really say about Absalom. So the king says unto him, he says, turn aside and stand here. Step aside and just wait. And so he turned aside and stood still. And behold, Cushi, the Cushite, came. And the Cushite said, tidings, my lord the king, for the Lord hath avenged thee this day of all of them that rose up against thee. And the king said unto Cushi, is the young man Absalom safe? And Cushi answered, the enemies of thy lord, my lord the king, and all that rise against thee to do thee hurt, be as that young man is. Interesting way of wording that. Did you notice that? Now, by the way, when you study world history and ancient texts and stuff like that, you know, the Greeks were pretty good at making a good story and spinning a yarn telling, you know, the details and stuff like that. But during this time, particularly of David, nobody was telling stories very well. If you read like the ancient Babylonian texts and stuff, like if they told this battle, they would just say something like, you know, the king's son was slain on the battlefield. And that's all they would say. Like all the ancient writings that we have that date way back to this time, it's funny how they don't get into the details. But I love how the Bible, way before any of the, you know, the people that were contemporary writers of that time, and, you know, even ancient stories that are even older than the Bible, like the Epic of Gilgamesh and some of that stuff, it just kind of doesn't tell the story very well. But man, I love how these ancient texts of the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, tells it as if we were standing right there today. And we're getting this detail that I think is important. Now what's interesting about that, just FYI for you Bible students, I don't believe it's there just for the amazing story. It makes for a cool story, hearing this emotion that David, like the first thing he's asking these messengers, is my son still safe? Is he safe? This isn't the stuff the Babylonians could care less about. Who cared what the father felt, that he was sad or worried about his son? Nobody cares about that. It's just about the battles. It's about the kingdom, the end. But I love these nuancey kinds of things. Now, it's not just there, however, for our flowery story and being intrigued. The reason I believe God puts it in the author of the Bible, the author's hand, as he inspires the writer of the Hebrew Bible, is because there's nuances that we're learning. And these details have meaning for us. And so that's why we take note of these nuances. But it sure makes for a good story, too. I love that. Even secular scholars of the Bible admit, man, the Bible kind of is sort of the pinnacle. Even if they won't give it the inspiration of God, which we do, they'll say, but at least it's an amazingly told story. Which is kind of interesting. So all that to say, we enjoy the story, but why would God have us see this? I think we'll learn a few things from this as we continue here. So, you know, is my son Absalom safe? But notice Cushi's answer is very careful. The enemies of my lord the king and all that rise against thee to do thee hurt, be as that young man. The implication is Cushi's carefully saying something that David, Absalom was your enemy and he's dead, as should all your enemies be. And I kind of sense that this is the preparation that Joab gave the Cushite, that perhaps Ahimaaz really wasn't ready or equipped or prepared to give that kind of an answer. It's not that he didn't know that Absalom was dead. He just didn't know how to break it to David. But I think Cushi has this wise way of putting it that kind of makes David not hack him up. And also for David to start to understand really what happened. And we're going to see, it's going to take David a while to figure out, man, I got to get on board with Absalom's death and understand that was actually a good thing. It's going to take David a while to get to this. So this is the beginning. I think this is Joab working with the Cushite to make sure that the proper message is portrayed and really instructing David how he's supposed to respond to the whole thing. I think it's kind of interesting because I wonder if there's the various kinds of messages that people try to give today. You've got partial message from Ahimaaz, but you've got this carefully thought through message of Cushi. And I think the Cushite is the guy that you want to know. It's interesting because in Romans chapter 10, verse 2, it speaks there of a person who has zeal without knowledge. Zeal without knowledge. I hear that from time to time from Christian people, where they want to, you know, be the one to give message, but they're not really willing to do the work to make sure they have the correct message. And they'll talk without understanding and have zeal, good intentions even, but they don't really know the right information. And thus, there's a clumsiness to it. I worry about that in our Christian faith. That's why I think it's good to know the scriptures, to do our best to keep studying the verses of the Bible so that we can have that knowledge to be able to give the complete message, to give the heart of God. I was asked last Sunday again by someone, what do you think about the book, The Shack? Do you guys remember that when it came out? And I was the jerk who had to sit around telling people, it's not the greatest book in the world. Don't read The Shack with just a blind stupidity. And I got a lot of heat from that because people were just all teary-eyed over The Shack. The problem is, it was zeal without knowledge. It was presenting a tiny percentage of who God is. And it was doing it in sort of an allegorical kind of way. And I understood the allegory of the shack and all this, but the problem was, if you just read the shack and let that be sort of your big thing, then you have a part of God, and you miss some of the most important aspects of God. So if you wanted to know God's grace and kindness, then you probably get that from the shack. But you won't ever hear about wrath, judgment, and death and hell and righteousness and stuff like that. That's sort of just sort of blown off in a lot of ways. And I think it's important, you know, if somebody's just writing a book saying, hey, let's talk about the grace of God, then that's great. But we need to say that's what we're doing. But in some ways, people took the shack and it was sort of written with zeal, but not the full knowledge. That's why Paul says, I have not shunned to declare unto you the whole counsel of God. You got to get the whole story. And there are times where books fall short that are not really given the full story of the Bible. I kind of see that in this. I see a guy who comes with some information and David says, step aside. And there Ahimeaz has to stand there. And then finally the Cushite comes and gives kind of the full story, but he's equipped to give David the information that he really needs and also that's most helpful to David. Be careful about how we deliver the message. Kind of an interesting little story about these runners and how they came and told this message to David. Well, David hears this message. And verse 33, the king was much moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, thus he said, oh, my son, Absalom, my son, Absalom, would God that I had died for thee. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. Man, this is like one of the more heart-wrenching verses in the whole Old Testament. As David is just wrenching in his heart because of his son's death. And it's going to get worse. I mean, we can kind of understand this right now. And I say, okay, David, yeah, I understand. You had this beautiful son, and you realize your own failure. See, I think that's why David says, oh, I would have died in your place. Because I think David is owning that his son was really kind of misguided because of his inactivity. You know, and he also knows that all of this happened because of his own sin with Bathsheba and Uriah the Hittite. And this was all what the Lord told him would happen because of his own failure. And David's feeling this just overwhelming grief. And he's saying, oh, I would have died in your place. You know, you got to wonder what Cushi was thinking, but at least he's probably thinking, wow, I'm glad he's going upstairs and not getting his sword out. But David is very grieved by this whole thing, you know. By the way, it's interesting. Compare this grief with David's grief that was seen way back in chapter 12, verses 20 through 23, when the baby that was born to he and Bathsheba, remember the baby? He, while it was still alive, just hanging, his life hanging in the balance, David was grieved and he was, you know, not eating and he had dirt on his head and that whole sackcloth and ashes thing. But remember when the baby died? He goes and takes a shower and eats some food and the people said, man, when the baby was alive, you were mourning. Now that the baby's dead, you're all happy and peppy. What's the deal? And David said, well, the baby was dead, and I was hoping that it would stay alive. But now that he's dead, I'm going to go see that baby. He shall not come to me, but I shall go to him. Speaking of heaven, David knew that he would see that baby in heaven. Why then does Absalom, in his death, not get the same kind of thought? I wonder, just something to think about, if David knew Absalom's heart was not toward God. Remember in the Old Testament, if you believed God, it would count for you for righteousness. Abraham believed God and it counted him to righteousness. Not so with Absalom. Absalom didn't seem to have a faith in God. There's no real reference to him really following after the Lord in any way, shape, or form. And I wonder if David knew that that would be the last he'd ever see of Absalom. Maybe that's why he's grieving so hard. It is interesting, being one who's done, you know, hundreds of funerals in my life, to see the difference of the behaviors and the different demeanors of the people at the funerals. Because if it's some old saint that was walking with the Lord all their days and, you know, they've got their Bible there on the table outside, you know, and you can see it's well read and there's, you know, writings and teardrop marks and you're like, okay, this is pretty cool. It's true, precious in the sight of the Lord is the death of his saints. And there's sort of a rejoicing and a joy even that can be at a memorial like that. But when you know a person really didn't walk with the Lord, maybe never knew the Lord, maybe even openly rejected the Lord, those are the memorial services where it's just really painful and kind of dark and cold and gloomy, and it's hard to have any hope. Those are the funerals where me and my pastor buddies here on staff, we just say, let's bring the gospel message. Because, you know, those people are there to hear about their friend, but maybe that's the good time for them to hear the good news of the gospel. So the thing I want to remind you about that, by the way, is I'm so glad about Jesus. Aren't you glad about Jesus? Because, you know, this story's getting kind of sad here. We've got death and destruction, and it's going to get worse. Chapter 19 is going to be even more bloody than the previous chapter. You're thinking, oh, this is so depressing and bad. But don't forget, everything we read here is just say, I'm glad about Jesus. Yeah, but Absalom died. But even as David said, oh, I would die in your place, Jesus, the son of David, did die in our place and took the sin upon himself. I'm so glad about Jesus. Yeah, but Brett, you know, this whole story of Absalom and the rebellion of a whole nation, it's just so depressing. They should have seen David as their king. Oh, but I'm so glad about Jesus, because the world rejects Jesus today largely, but he's going to come and rule and reign upon this earth, and he's going to take the throne, and it's going to make all the things that are wrong right. I'm so glad about Jesus. Like every time you find yourself getting depressed reading the Old Testament, don't forget to say, but I'm glad about Jesus. Because the whole book's about Jesus. It should point us to Jesus, and it should cheer us back up. Amen? Amen. Amen. You're going to need that for this next chapter. Verse 1, it says, and it was told Joab, behold, the king weepeth and mourneth for Absalom. And the victory that day was turned into mourning unto all the people. For the people heard say that day how the king was grieved for his son. And the people got them by stealth that day into the city, as people being ashamed steal away, and they flee in the battle. But the king covered his face, and the king cried with a loud voice, oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son. Is it starting to get embarrassing now? I mean, David, come on, buddy, pull up. Why would he pull up? Well, he's the king. And he was just delivered of a whole army. 20,000 people were killed in this battle. I mean, there's a much bigger picture than just his son Absalom. And there's a point when you're in a place of leadership, you got to step up, even though you're in pain. And David's not really willing to do that. He's just kind of uncontrollably mourning and sobbing. And there's this weird picture, you know, the people are all victorious. Yes, we won the victory. You know, the people that were faithful to David, the people that fought for David, they're rejoicing, but then they're like, psst, 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 no more rejoicing. Why? Because David's really, really sad. When you go, in fact, when you get to town, sneak in and just go to your house and no celebrating tonight, which is really kind of a sad thing. These people, they were rejoicing out in the field of battle. Now they got to go, oh, yeah, David's really sad. Well, Joab, who's about as sensitive as a brick, it says here in verse 5, and Joab came into the house to the king and said, thou hast shamed this day the faces of all thy servants, which this day have saved thy life, and the lives of thy sons and thy daughters, and the lives of thy wives, and the lives of thy concubines, in that thou lovest thine enemies and hatest thy friends. For thou hast declared this day that thou regardest neither princes nor servants, for this day I perceive that if Absalom had lived and all we had died this day, then it had pleased you well. Now therefore arise, go forth and speak comfortably or to the heart of thy servants, for I swear by the Lord, if thou go not forth, there will not tarry one with thee this night, and that will be worse unto thee than all the evil that befell thee from thy youth until now. Joab saying, dude, pull it together. Don't you realize your kingdom is still hanging by a thread? Here all these people fought for you, this tiny group of people compared to Absalom's army, and they won. And they should be able to come back and celebrate that their king is seated back on the throne, but you're moping around and making them all feel bad, and you could lose even them. Like this is an important thing that you pull up. I wonder if there's a little bit of a lesson here. You know, David's gonna step up to this, and we'll see him do this. But I wonder if sometimes, depending on what level of leader you are. Well, Brett, I'm not a leader. You are if you're a parent. You are if you're an employee or a manager. I wonder if there's a time where you should kind of put aside your emotions and really fight through that and say, I'm going to choose to lead in confidence. You know, it's funny to watch the old war movies and stuff, but one of those, I think it was We Were Brothers or something like that. Remember there's the guy who's kind of one of the, you know, lieutenants that's leading these guys into battle. Who's the guy? Elliot, the guy with the big mustache? He's got that deep voice like this. Anyway, favorite scene of all, the camera guy's there on the battlefield. He's shaking and hiding in the weeds like this, and he comes walking and standing. There's bullets just zing, 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 by, you know, flying through there, and he's just standing up. He says, you ain't going to get any pictures down there, sonny. And he kind of just walks off confidently. His bullets are zinging by. It's a good way to get killed. But in the movie, it's a great moment of just kind of this guy leading in the midst of all these guys dying in battle and stuff. And, you know, you think, man, that takes some real, you know, toughness, some chutzpah to stand there and take it in battle. I wonder, Mom, what does that have to do with me? I'm a mom. Should have given a Pride and Prejudice illustration. I would if there was anything of value. Oh, I'm sorry. Just kidding. Whoa, I sense anger. Anger coming from some of the ladies. Okay, I'll work on that one. I'll come up with a Pride and Prejudice illustration. But, Mom, I wonder if your kids are watching you freak out or be really sad by something or be very worried or uptight. You're saying, well, Brett, I have a right to be. Well, I think we do. I think we all have a right sometimes to grieve with those who grieve and mourn with those who most. But when you're in a place of leadership, which as a mom or a father or a dad, you are. And sometimes, let me just give you an example. I wonder if, you know, your finances are really bad right now. And you're broke. And your budget's not working out. And you're thinking, how are we going to survive this? And you're kind of depressed and gloomy. And, you know, and your husband's trying to encourage you. But when he goes off to work or whatever, and you're there stuck with those kids at home, I wonder if maybe you could hear this word from Joab. And you forget that your husband's on your side and that he's trying to help too. And that your kids are watching how you react to financial trouble. And little do you know, you're teaching them how to react to financial trouble. Your behavior, because you're a leader in your own home, that behavior needs to be thought through and carefully calculated. Think, man, I know I should be technically depressed and sad right now, but I'm going to put on a face of confidence in the Lord. But I don't have confidence in the Lord. That's the problem. Put on the face of confidence. Because the Bible says, put ye on the Lord Jesus Christ. You see, I think there's something really good about teaching and instructing by just being. And that's what Joab is trying to say. David, you got to pull up. I know you're grieved by your situation. And I'm just saying moms, because that's just one side of it. You know, dads, it's the same thing. If things are not good and you're grouchy and grumpy and you're treating your family badly because things aren't going good for you, you're teaching them that it's okay to be grouchy and grumpy when things don't go your way. It's amazing to think of the lessons that we're teaching, whether we like it or not. And, I don't care what anybody thinks. Well, that's the problem. That's why a lot of kids grow up. And at the first sign of financial trouble, they get depressed and worried because that's what mom did or that's what dad did or get grouchy or perturbed. It's amazing how we pass these things on just by our example and by our attitudes and actions. There's something good about the person who learns to put aside the emotion and say, okay, I do feel sad. And there is a time to mourn and a time to weep, but right now is not that time. And to be people of God who learn to step up, put our trust in God, and believe that truly all things do, in fact, work together for the good, and just say, Lord, it's all going to be good. But Brett, life is not fair. It is fair. Remember? What's fair? Death. Death is fair. That's what's fair. Life is more than fair. And that's why everybody will say before God, righteous and true are your judgments, O Lord. Nobody's going to say, that's not fair when you get to heaven. That's just a stupid human saying. Life's not fair. It is. We don't know all the ins and outs. We don't know God's plan and purpose and reasons. We don't know why this life, this little boot camp, things happen the way they do. But in the bigger picture of eternity, we will all say life was fair and God is good. So why not just remember that and say, okay, I'm going to put away my emotion for a second and make sure that I'm leading the little crew that I have that I'm supposed to be leading and not be freaked out. Something to think about. I know that might be hard for some to hear that, but you know, it's something that I think that we're doing to sort of train our kids maybe in the wrong direction in a lot of ways, or the people that we work with, or the people that are employed under us, whatever, to put on the good face and trust the Lord. That's what David's got to do. So what does he do? It says this, verse 8, then the king arose and sat in the gate, and they told unto all the people, saying, behold, the king doth sit in the gate. And all the people came before the king, for Israel had fled every man to his tent. They were all shaken in their sandals in their tents, thinking the king's freaked out. But now David is, sitting in the gate means nothing to us, but in Bible times, it means I'm back. Absalom's dead, I'm back. To sit in the gate was in a place of authority. In fact, it would be even more of a place of authority than going back and sitting in a throne in his palace. But to sit in the gate of the city, there was a special place where the king would sit in the gate. And that would be saying, I'm in charge, and anybody got a problem with that? That's kind of what David's doing here. And it's a way for the people to say, yes, David's back on the throne, and everything's good now. And so he does sort of a press conference here at the gate of the city where the people come all out and see him, and he puts on a good face. And is not weeping and screaming, oh, Absalom, my son, no more of that. He's putting on the good face at the press conference. Good stuff. Well, verse 9, and all the people were at strife throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, the king saved us out of the hand of our enemies, and he delivered us out of the hand of the Philistines, and now he has fled out of the land for Absalom. And Absalom, who we anointed over us, is dead in battle. Now, therefore, why speak ye not a word of bringing back the king, or bringing the king back? See, the men here, interesting of Israel, they're, you got to understand, the people that are standing at the gate with David, those are the people that fought with him. But there's still the other side who's saying, man, the guy that we chose to go with, Absalom, he's now dead, and we should have been escorting David back in to let him know we're good with him. We should have been the one to bring him in and take care of him. And they're realizing they're in kind of a predicament, which they are. But here's where it gets funny. David's going to beat them to the punch. They're thinking, maybe we should do something. So it says, verse 11, and then King David sent Zadok and Abiathar the priest, saying, speak to the elders of Judah, saying, why are you the last to bring the king back into his house? Seeing the speech of all Israel has come to the king, even to his house. You are my brethren. You are my bones and my flesh. Wherefore then are you the last to bring back the king? David comes to them first before they get a chance to come out and, you know, show their support for him. He says, why aren't you guys? You guys are my family, men of Judah. You guys should be the first ones. And so he sort of gets on their case for doing that. So you got to understand, the kingdom is still in sort of a tense moment. They don't know what to do. There's still people that don't know what to do. There's even going to be another little uprising here shortly of an Absalom supporter who's going to try to surface and bring up another rebellion against David. Like, this is the sword that's going to be always on the house of David because of his sin, and it's going to plague him to the day he dies. So he's trying to put out these fires. He's trying to get things back in order, but it's never going to quite happen perfectly. Well, it's from this point where we saw on Sunday the road to restoration. That is where David starts to look at individuals who were involved with the military coup and the battle with Absalom, and he starts to do deeds and acts that would lead to restoration. We saw verses 11. Through 15 of chapter 19, an extension of grace to a character named Amasa. And Amasa was the guy who led the army for Absalom. And so, remember, David gave Absalom Joab's job. Remember that? in place of Joab. And there's still a little question about how Joab, what was Joab's role? Did Amasa really take over for Absalom? There's still a question about that. But we'll see a little hint more tonight about how that took place as we keep going. So he shows grace by giving Amasa that which he doesn't deserve. Then in verses 16 through 23, we saw on Sunday an expression of mercy in the person of Shimei, the dirt clod thrower. And David wasn't gracious to him, but he was merciful. He let him off the hook for throwing rocks and dirt clods at him and calling him a bloody man. And we talked about that. And then we saw in verses 24 through 30 an exemplary faithfulness in the character of Mephibosheth. And if you recall, Phoebe was the guy who said, "Man, I don't care about all my possessions. All I want is to be with the king. Ziba can have all the Saul's stuff. I just want to be with you." And I hope our Christianity looks like that too. If God took away everything that you possess and all your comforts and all your, you know, things that you enjoy, and all you have is Jesus, if you were still saying, "That's all I need. If all I have is Jesus, that's all I need." That was where Mephibosheth really was. And then lastly on Sunday, we saw the fourth guy, Barzillai. We saw an excellent attitude in Barzillai, verses 31 through 40, where Barzillai was always seen putting others in front of himself. Even when the king said, "Hey, Barzillai, 80-year-old guy, I want you as an old man to come and live your last days with me, the king, and eat at my table." And we commended Barzillai on Sunday for saying, "Oh, that's thanks a lot, but send Kimham in my place. Let him enjoy the blessing that you were going to give to me." And we commended him for that. And then depending on what service you were at, we went through different, I don't think I quite went through verses 39 and 40, and I don't want you Wednesday nighters to miss any of that. So Barzillai, after asking that of David, verse 39, it says, "And all the people went over Jordan, and when the king was come over, the king kissed Barzillai and blessed him, and he returned to his own place. And the king went on to Gilgal, and Kimham went with him, and all the people of Judah conducted the king, and also half the people of Israel." So Barzillai heads back over the Jordan to where he lived. Now, let me just throw out something for the other side of the coin to consider about Barzillai. Because I really wanted you to see on Sunday the good side of him. I think there's a lot of good in Barzillai. But if when I stand before the throne and I happen to bump into Barzillai in heaven, I'm going to ask him this question when I meet Barzillai. "Hey, dude, when you had the opportunity to go eat at the king's table and spend time with David and live out your days in his palace, did you ever regret that, not going with the king?" Because do you remember what he wanted to do? He wanted to go back and, you know, live in his hometown and be buried with his father and his mother, and sort of these, what some might call the worldly concerns. He wanted to do those things more than be with the king. And I just wonder, you know, I see how Jesus talks about how really the faithful would have to eventually leave father, mother, sister, and brother and follow him. And there's even that guy who says, "Oh, let me go bury my father and my mother, then I'll follow you." And Jesus said, "That's not really the way it works." And I wonder if Barzillai would regret not going with the king. The goal for all of us should be to be with Jesus, the son of David, if you would. Just something to think about. Would I give Barzillai a hard time for this? No. But it is something for us to think about. So these are the four people, we see four things. We see an extension of grace, an expression of mercy, an exemplary faithfulness, and an excellent attitude in Barzillai. Well, it goes on. Let's keep reading. So it says there in verse 41, "And behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, 'Why have our brethren, the men of Judah, stolen thee away and have brought the king and his household and all of David's men with him over Jordan?' And all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, 'Because the king is near to kin of us.'" We're family, you know. "Why are you angry for this matter?" He says, "Have we eaten all the king's cost, or hath he given us any gift?" And the men of Israel answered the men of Judah and said, "We have 10 parts in the king, and we also have more right to David than you. Why then did you despise us, that our advice should not be first had in bringing back our king? And the words of the men of Judah were fiercer than the words of the men of Israel. Uh-oh. We got a family feud going on between the men of Judah and then the northern 10 tribes. They were saying, we have 10 parts of David. Now they're fighting over David. Before they were trying to kill him. Now they're saying, hey, we have more dibs on David than you guys. Now, do you recall why did the men of Judah escort David? Was it because they had a good idea? Hey, let's be the first ones to escort David. Is that what happened? No, David said, you men of Judah, you're my family. You guys should be the first ones to escort me back as a king. This is all stuff that they would have known back then. So the men of Judah said, okay, and they apparently were the first ones. But the rest of Israel says, who do you guys think you are? This is just your typical misunderstanding among family members, among church members. It's amazing to me. That's probably, of all the years of ministry, I still marvel at how misunderstandings happen of things people say and what people do and how people get all upset at each other. Oh, it's troublesome. It really is. I wonder if we all just took a whole lot more things a whole lot less more serious and just stopped thinking, what are those guys thinking? What did he mean really by saying that or the other thing? And we got to chill out, totally chill out. I'll never forget Debbie and I at our wedding. There was it was our rehearsal dinner, and there were two men. I'm not going to tell you who they were, but there were two men that were at our rehearsal dinner, and one was just a nice guy and was doing pretty well in life, and we were able to have conversations with him about the Lord, and we were kind of working on him a little bit. But then there was another guy at our wedding rehearsal dinner who was just completely lost and stubborn and prideful and just kind of like way past our skill set. So what we did, Debbie and I, we really loved our pastor so much, and we were so excited because he was going to be at our rehearsal dinner. So we thought, hey, let's set our pastor right next to the guy that needs all the work. And this will be great because, you know, you got to understand, Pastor John's the most friendly guy you'd ever know. I mean, just, and he's a real delight to have a conversation with. I mean, you know, whenever we go to dinner with Pastor John and Tammy, my sister and you know, her husband, John, you go away pumped and like, yeah, the Lord is good. So we're just like, this is going to be awesome. Well, what happened? Well, Pastor John had a great conversation with that guy, and it really made a difference in his life. And ultimately, about 10 years later, partially due to that whole situation, about 10 or 12 years later, that man eventually accepted Christ and became a believer and was saved. The man that was we thought was pretty squared away and doing good, and we had a good relationship with, thought it was going to be great, he saw that that old Pastor John could care less about him. And that he was shunning him. And he was angry. He was furious. He said, I really don't like that John Corson because he just spent all that time talking to that other guy. And he was really, really upset. And Debbie and I were in a real predicament because we didn't want to say, well, we purposefully set him over there and you over here because we like you. And we thought you were squared away. Apparently not. No, we didn't say that. We didn't say that. Is that kind of fair way to put it, Deb, the way, do you remember all this? And it was so sad because for years this man thought ill of my pastor, and my pastor had no idea any of it was going on. He just had dinner and was talking to the guy sitting next to him. It's so funny how people can get just their whole thing up in a tizzy for just stupid stuff. And man, you see that all throughout the Bible. And the Lord tells us over and over about these stories. Remember that other nation that thought David just wanted to show kindness to, but they thought they were trying to spy, and more than 20,000 people were killed in battle because of a misunderstanding. I hope that none of us are fuel for those misunderstandings within the Church of Jesus Christ. I hope that we're big-hearted, and you know what? Here's what I found. I was talking with a buddy today about this. It's kind of funny how these things all kind of come up in the Bible at interesting times, but we were talking about how, isn't it funny how you know, most people are just trying to do their best in general. You know, I think that so many times we interpret things as bad or wrong, or that guy said something to be mean. But most of the time, I'm just finding rarely is there any ill will or anything mean meant or any problem really trying to be. Maybe they said something wrong and didn't realize how it came off or those kinds of things. But that's why I think if we're going to be guilty of something, let's just be guilty of being super gracious and super forgiving, not assuming that's what they meant, and even at the risk of being hurt further. That's what we need to do, is be careful about this. The men of Judah, the men of Israel, they're all chiding against one another. And the only reason the men of Judah get away with it, because they're more fierce than the men of Israel. Like, shut up and sit down. They're like, okay. That's the way it goes down. I mean, it's just kind of horrible. It wasn't ended by a peaceful resolution. It's just that the men of Judah could kill them if they wanted to. So they kind of stop talking. That's not a good way to end things. Be careful on this one, folks. Let's be gracious one to another. Kind, tenderhearted, forgiving one another before they're even sorry. Even as God, for Christ's sake, forgave us. Well, quickly, we'll just see how far we get in chapter 20. It says in verse 1, and there happened to be there a man of Belial. Does anybody remember what the word Belial means? Worthless. A worthless dude. Whose name was Sheva, the son of Bichri, a Benjamite. And he blew a trumpet and said, we have no part in David. Now, you understand, it's not that he's saying we want no part of David. He's saying we have no part, referring back to verse 43 where the men of Judah said, we have 10 parts in the king. He's saying, well, we have no parts. It's not fair. So David's not on our side at all. That's kind of what he's saying. We have no part in David, neither have we an inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel. So every man of Israel went up from after David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri, but the men of Judah clave to their king from Jordan even to Jerusalem. So this little tizzy that took place here in verse 43 is now this guy Sheba is capitalizing on it, saying, okay, men of Israel, follow me, because David, we have no part with him. And this is going to be a bad thing. You know, whenever you see a guy step up like this trying to get ahead, this will prove not to be a way to get ahead. For you guys that know the Bible studies that I give, you know probably what's going to happen when I say that. But this one's really bad. I'll just give you forewarning. Verse 3, David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women, his concubines, whom he had left to keep the house, and put them in ward, and fed them, but went not in unto them, or didn't have intimacy, romance with them. And it says, so they were shut up unto the day of their death, living in widowhood. Brett, that's not fair. Life is fair. That's all I'm going to say about that. Brett, that's not fair. Those poor ladies, life is fair. God knows about these ladies. And while their life must have been hard, and oftentimes women were treated so badly in these times, I mean, if you follow these poor women, they were concubines. Who knows how they became David's concubines? But they became his concubines. And then when he got kicked out, Absalom goes and sleeps with them in the special tent they made on top of the roof. Remember the story? And now David's back. And boy, you know, what this shows us is how this is the way sexual immorality actually shakes out. That when a guy, you know, has made a stupid decision like David, having multiple wives and concubines, and these poor women are kind of the victims. And I would just say, isn't it interesting how women still, to this day, are the victims largely of all this sexual immorality that takes place in our culture? I think this is a great reminder of what sexual impurity and immorality does to women. And it's really a tragic thing. Now, I believe you can't outgive God, and I think God's going to somehow take care of these ladies. Maybe it has to do with eternity. Maybe it's not going to be here in this world because they're locked up in a room for the rest of their lives, and they just get food, and that's pretty much it. I bet they got really good at, like, you know, solitaire or something. But what a boring, horrible way to go down as a widow, even though the king had you as his concubine. Now they're just shut up there for the rest of their lives. Brutal. Well, verse 4, then said the king to Amasa. Question, who's Amasa? Anybody remember? Bam, Absalom's former commander of the army. The one that David was gracious. He said, okay, you can have Joab's job. Remember? So David says to Amasa, who's now the commander of his army, assemble me the men of Judah within 3 days, and thou be thou here present. In other words, be ready with your army in 3 days. So Amasa went to assemble the men of Judah, but tarried longer than the set time which he had appointed him. Apparently, he didn't get it done in time. Is that a good kind of thing for a commanding officer to not show up in time? So David, verse 6, said to Abishai, "Now shall Sheba, the son of Bichri, do us more harm than did Absalom. Take thou thy Lord's servant and pursue after him," that's the guy named Sheba, "pursue after him, lest he get him into a fenced city and escape us." In other words, don't let, you know, this guy, Sheba, get away too far into some fortified city where we won't be able to get to him. And he said, Abishai, which is one of his trusted soldiers, you know, the mighty man, Abishai, we talked about him before, "You got to make this happen. My new dude's failing me." Well, verse 7, there went out after Joab's men. Notice how they're called Joab's men still, even though they're technically Amasa's friends or men. There went out after him Joab's men and the Kerethites and the Pelethites and all the mighty men, and they went out of Jerusalem to pursue after Sheba, the son of Bichri. Now, interesting, the Kerethites and the Pelethites, we wouldn't know anything about them, where they're from. They're only mentioned a couple other times in the Bible, but we know nothing about who these people are. There's only one hint. Oftentimes, the Kerethites and the Pelethites are mentioned also with a third group called the Gittites. And does anybody remember who's a Gittite? Goliath was a Gittite because he was from Gath. And a Gittite was a person from Gath. Are you guys with me? We talked about that a couple weeks ago, so I was just seeing if anybody was listening. Apparently not. just messing with you. So the reason that you say that's whatever is, I think it's interesting. These are probably people, these Kerethites and Pelethites that are marching with David's mighty men. They probably were, they became like compadres during David's time at Ziklag when he was living there with, you know, the Philistines. Remember that whole story? These are probably guys that became close in battle, and they said, "We're with you guys. We're going to stand with you guys." They might have even been Philistines, some people argue. So that's kind of an interesting deal, these Kerethites and Pelethites who join in with the mighty men. I think that's kind of cool. By the way, whenever I see a Gentile in the Old Testament teaming up with a Jew and standing with them, what does that make you think of? The church. That's right. Because we were on the outside. We were the Philistine as Gentiles. But the Lord has allowed us to join in with the mighty men of David, if you would. You know, I see some good news there. Again, I'm so thankful for Jesus. I'm glad about Jesus. Well, verse 8 says, and when they were at the great stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa went before them, and Joab's garment that he had put on was girded unto him. So he's wearing Joab's clothing, his armor. And it says, Joab's garment, which he had put on him, girded with him, and upon a girdle with a sword fastened upon his loins, in the sheath thereof, as he went forth, it fell out. What are we supposed to think about Amasa? So far, he's kind of reminding me of Barney Fife on the Andy Griffith show. He's okay, I'll be there, I'll bring your king, and he doesn't show up. And then when he finally shows up, he shows up with his armor, but his sword's falling on the ground and stuff. Like, you don't let your sword fall on the ground. That's like the most embarrassing thing a soldier could have happen, let alone the commanding officer. The guy's a total poser. Well, verse 9, and Joab said to Amasa, "Art thou in health, my brother?" He's like, "You all right, bro?" But check this out. "Are you all right, my brother?" And Joab took Amasa by the beard and with the right hand to kiss him. But Amasa took no heed to the sword that was in Joab's hand. So he smote him there with the fifth rib and shed out his bowels on the ground and struck him not again, and he died. So Joab and Abishai, his brother, pursued after Sheba, the son of Bichri. And one of Joab's men stood by him and said, he that favoreth Joab, he that is for David, let him go after Joab. In other words, let's follow Joab. He's our guy now. He's the new commander again. Verse 12, and Amasa wallowed in blood in the midst of the highway. Apparently Amasa is a Mesa. Sorry. Just trying to lighten the mood just a little. So he's wallowing in his blood in the highway. And when the men saw it, that all the people stood still, he removed Amasa out of the highway into the field and cast a cloth upon him. And when he saw that everyone that came by him stood still, he was removed out of the highway, and all the people went on after Joab to pursue after Sheva, the son of Bichri. So that's the end of Amasa. He was a guy who was following Absalom, but never really had a chance to lead the army. And Joab's back in charge. Didn't take long, about 10 seconds. Quickly, verse 14, and he went through all the tribes of Israel and to Abel, to Bet Maaca, and all of the Berites. And they were also gathered together and went also after him. And they came to besiege him. This is the guy Sheva, the guy that blew the horn and said, nobody gives us a part of David. And so he and the men fled, and now they're hiding in this place called Abel. And so verse 15, they came to this besieged city of Abel, of Bet Maaca, and they cast up a bank against the city, and it stood in the trench, and all the people that were with Joab battered the wall to throw it down. Then, verse 16, there cried a wise woman out of the city, hear, say, I pray you, unto Joab, come near hither, that I may speak with you. So this wise woman yells over the wall of this city, Abel. This is weird, man. Here's Joab pounding on the doors of the city, beating it down with a battering ram. And this lady's like, excuse me. This is great. A wise woman. And so she says, verse 17, when he came near to her, the woman said, art thou Joab? And he answered and said, I am he. And then she said unto him, hear the words of thine handmaid. And he answered, I do hear. And she spake, saying, they were wont to speak in old time, saying, they shall surely ask counsel at Abel. And so they ended the matter. I am one of them that are peaceable and faithful in Israel. Thou seekest to destroy a city and a mother in Israel. Why wilt thou swallow up the inheritance of the Lord? In other words, this city's known for wisdom, is what she's saying. And I'm one of the mothers in Israel. Why are you trying to take us down as a whole city? And Joab answered and said, far be it from me that I should swallow up or destroy. Oh, really? Remember the guy bubbling in blood on the way, just saying, why should I ever, destroy anything? Verse 21, the matter is not so, but a man of Mount Ephraim, Sheba, the son of Bichri by name, hath lifted up his hand against the king, even against David. Deliver him only, and I will depart from the city. And the woman said to Joab, behold, his head shall be thrown to thee over the wall. This is where volleyball was invented. Sorry. No, I just made that up. I'm sorry. So then verse 22, the woman went unto all the people in her wisdom, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and cast it to Joab, and he blew a trumpet. That was not Sheba. Joab blew the trumpet. It'd be hard for, anyway. But he's the one who blew the trumpet first. Remember, he's blowing his own trumpet, getting people to follow him. And now he loses his head over that. And they retired from the city, every man to his tent, and Joab returned to Jerusalem unto the king. Now Joab was over all the host of Israel, and Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Kerethites, over the Pelethites, and Adoram was over the tribute, and Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder, and Sheva was the scribe, and Zadok and Abiathar were the priests, and Ira, the Jairite, was the chief ruler about David. Then, one more verse. Then there was famine in the days of David, 3 years, year after year. And David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered. We'll stop there, but the reason I wanted you to see that first verse of that next chapter is it just keeps going. Now that they got all the sword issues and warfare taken care of, now they've got 3 years of famine in the land, year after year. But what I love is even though David's having a hard time of it, like God said it would happen, finally we see him do something he did when he was younger. Finally we see David inquire of the Lord, and that's the answer. Whenever you find yourself, maybe you're in a place where you're like, man, one thing after another. Maybe you've been sick for a really long time and hurting. Maybe you've been financially in trouble. Maybe you don't have hope and you're discouraged. You got to remember to do what David finally does here, and he inquires of the Lord and seeks after the Lord, and the Lord answers. Don't forget, that's how it works. Good thing to remember. Well, Lord, we are thankful for these reminders of truth in these stories. And I would pray, Lord, that tonight as we consider your word, that we would see just how relationships can go awry so quickly and so easily, and misunderstandings can be turned into stuff that's so much out of proportion. But I would pray, Lord, that you would help us to grow in that area and be big-hearted and forgiving. And you even told us that blessed are the peacemakers. Lord, help us to learn what that means, to not stir up things, but to be peacemakers, not to be bitter about things, but to be forgiving. And Lord, where we don't know what to do, give us understanding of how to best follow your word, and to teach us to inquire of you what we're to do, that you will direct our path. So Lord, we take this scripture now and commit it to you into our hearts, and pray that you just help us to meditate on your word day and night. In Jesus' name, amen.
To take advantage of our media ministry, we encourage you to visit us anytime at athecreek.com. where we have all of Pastor Brett's Bible studies available as a free download.